Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting on the Committee of Health and Human Service Policy to order. We do not have a quorum, so we will begin with House File A-15 and Representative Acom. This your first bill in this committee?
Well, it is. Was I supposed to bring cookies?
That's okay.
I have some IP in my office. I'll bring them back when I'm done. How's that? Sorry about that. I ran for a meeting over in the Senate building, and I got a little flummoxed. Freshman, okay. a rookie mistake, I should say.
We forgive you.
Thank you.
So the chair moves that House File A-15 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, we have the bill before the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for providing the opportunity to present my bill, House File 815, today. I am joined by Dan Anderson with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. House File 815 applies step therapy overrides procedures to state public health care programs. To provide a little background on my bill, step therapy, for those of you that are new, looks like maybe not all the freshmen are here, but this bill did come before the committee last year as well. But the step therapy protocols, sometimes referred to as failed first, requires patients to first try and fail at least one medication chosen by a health plan before the health plan will cover the medication that was originally prescribed by the provider. For those living with a serious chronic illness, prolonging ineffective treatment and delaying access to the right medication may result in possible disease progression, loss of function, and adverse effects. My husband, who has multiple sclerosis, faced treatment delays from step therapy. And as a spouse of a person who lives with a chronic disease, it's hard to watch each day be a challenge and then made only harder by taking medications that provide awful side effects, and especially when the doctors know that these side effects can happen. So for those of you who were on the committee last year, this bill may seem familiar. Last year's bill was House File 3196 and provided an override process to step therapy for those on private insurance. My bill adds this benefit for those on public insurance programs such as Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance, ensuring equal protections for lower-income patients. DHS has reviewed the bill and added two technical changes to align the bill with state's prescription drug formulary process, with their process. So Dan was involved in the passage of the original bill, and I'd like to give him an opportunity to provide some additional information to the committee.
Thank you so much. Could you please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen. I'm the Senior Manager of Advocacy with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, whose mission is to help the over 12,000 Minnesotans living with multiple sclerosis live their best lives. The society, along with several patient and provider groups, which are listed in the letter in your packets, support House File 815, and we thank Representative Acom for bringing this bill forward. Last session, the legislature unanimously supported the creation of override process for to address step therapy protocols. Under this new law that went into effect January 1st, providers may request an override of a step therapy requirement if their patient would have an adverse reaction or be harmed by taking the preferred medication, if their patient has tried and failed on a similar medication, or the patient has changed insurance coverage and are already stable on an existing medication. For Minnesotans living with a chronic disease, timely access to life-changing medications is critical. As Representative mentioned, the bill last year only applied to private insurance. DHS was currently going through a process of kind of reformulating their preferred drug program, the bill last year did not apply to them, and now that they're a little bit further in that process, we wanted to try to bring them into these levels of protection. So that by passing House File 815, you'll ensure that all Minnesotans covered under a state-regulated health plan will have the same level of protection of step therapy, whether they're enrolled in private insurance, medical assistance, or Minnesota Care. Thank you for your willingness to hear this important issue. will significantly improve the lives of Minnesotans living with complex chronic diseases.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Representative Acom, do you have any other testifiers?
No, it's just us.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Members, any discussions, any questions? Okay. We're going to lay the bill over until we have a quorum. Thank you so much, and stick around.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So we have our next bill up, House File 929. Welcome to the committee, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The chair moves that House File 929 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, we have the bill before the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 929 would expand eligibility for the Traumatic Brain Injury Program by including people with a brain injury acquired by prenatal alcohol exposure. The bill would direct the Commissioner of Human Services to seek to amend the brain injury waiver to include eligible persons who meet the level of care requirements with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, is a medical condition that's present at birth as a result to exposure to alcohol in utero. In simple terms, you can think of it as a form of brain injury. It's a permanent condition, it lasts a lifetime, and currently there is no cure. Current prevalence rates of FASD released by the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2018 estimate that 1 in 20 U.S. school children have an FASD. FASD is a spectrum condition, and the symptoms can vary across individuals. Not everyone with an FASD will qualify for a brain injury waiver, but for some of those that are the most profoundly impacted, they are falling through the cracks. These individuals meet the level of care requirements, but they're unable to participate in the brain injury program because state statute excludes people with congenital brain injuries. As a result, people with an FASD are left out on the basis that their brain injury occurred before they were born. Because FASD is a spectrum condition, we need a spectrum of supports. For some people, their needs may be more effectively met with a CADI waiver. For a smaller proportion, their needs may be more suited for a developmental disability waiver, and a subset of this population would be better served under the brain injury waiver. We have an opportunity to meet people with the supports that they need early to avoid the onset of more complex forms of secondary challenges and the issues that we see when primary needs are unmet, including school disruption, caregiver fatigue, economic hardship, housing insecurity, and mental health challenges. This is an opportunity to ensure that individuals with an FASD that meet the level of care are not left out of accessing this essential service. With that, I can stand for questions or I can introduce our next testifier.
Yes, so thank you for your testimony for bringing this bill to this committee. Why don't we move to your testifier and have her introduce herself for the record and proceed with her testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Wallen. I am the mother of a 21-year-old son with an FASD. Unlike many family members of affected individuals, I have a PhD, an MBA. I've worked in academia, in the corporate world, and in the nonprofit arena. I am skilled in tackling problems, locating appropriate resources, and obtaining successful outcomes. Unfortunately, trying to raise my son has brought me to my knees. I have drained our family's personal resources. I had to give up my career, and my health has suffered, trying to shepherd my son to adulthood and keep him safe. Because I love my son and outcomes for these individuals tend to be very bleak, I continue to fight on his behalf. Every single day brings another battle to obtain resources, explain his disability to others, and help him maintain hope. I've educated teachers, therapists, doctors, case managers, employment coaches, sports coaches, senior county administrators, care providers, and judges who have little to no understanding of my son's disability. Even if these individuals understand, however, institutionalized supports do not exist. It is unbelievable to me that a disability affecting a large group of people and families isn't recognized as the permanent brain injury that it is. My son has been punished and stigmatized for poor decision-making, impulsivity, and memory problems. Other kids taunted him for his low vision, his short stature, and his speech impediment, all issues related to prenatal alcohol exposures. These individuals deserve the dignity of having their disability recognized and to be able to access resources that can assist them in living productive, satisfying, and safe lives. My son has been accepted to Dunwoody, he works a job, and he volunteers in the community. This is only possible because our school district learned how to work with him, I've been able to obtain some resources for him, and our family has remained devoted to helping him. Others with the disability are not so fortunate. I implore you to consider the lives of these individuals and the people who love them. My humble hope is that I could speak for our family, but also for the thousands of individuals and families who are simply struggling to survive. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in today to testify and share your story about your son. Really appreciate it. Do you have other testifiers, represent?
No, that's the only one.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 929? Okay. And for members, we have a quorum that is present. So do we have any questions from members on the bill? All right. So there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 929 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say
aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 929 is recommended for a re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So can we bring Representative Aiken?
Yep. So since we're transitioning, we'll send around my state cookbook.
Yes, promised. Thank you.
Girl Scout cookie day, so
that is
good. Good, 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 good.
You're terrible. Pass wrong with Girl Scout cookie.
Better late than never.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, gee, twist her arm.
I know, I know. There you go. Take and pass.
Yeah.
Okay. It's open the other end. The other end's open.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because it makes some people eligible. So
Representative Akam, can you come up to the testifier?
Do I need my paper?
Sure. I think you'll be okay. No, you're fine. You're fine.
Sorry.
So, Representative Akam introduced House File 815. I just wanted to give members another opportunity to ask questions if you have any questions. Okay. Since there's no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 815 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
House File 815 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much. So since we have a quorum present, may I get a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday, February the 26th?
So moved.
So moved. Representative Freiberg moves approval of the minutes for Tuesday, February the 26th. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for Tuesday, February the 26th, are approved. Okay, so do we have Representative Bernardi? House File 926. So the chair moves House File 926 to be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Welcome, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the hearing. I appreciate it today.
Yes.
I will proceed first, and then I have a witness here to provide testimony today as well.
Please continue.
So I'm going to take you on a little history of why we may have gotten to where we are today regarding this issue. In July of 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed into the law the creation of Medicare under Title 18 of the Social Security Act. At that time, there was no awareness about obesity as a disease. Coverage for obesity care was not considered under Medicare, a situation that largely remains the same even in 2019. In 2004, the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services removed the phrase, obesity is not an illness. In 2006, it issued a ruling for coverage of weight loss surgery. Coverage for office visits, laboratory testing, medical nutrition therapy, and medication for weight loss was not included. The pressure is on for the federal government to change its obsolete positions on coverage for obesity care. Madam Chair, could you ask for kind of quiet in the audience? I'm getting distracted. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. The pressure is on for the federal government to change its obsolete positions on coverage for obesity care. The American Medical Association, which recognized obesity as a chronic disease requiring a range of medical intervention in 2013, formalized the position of all other medical organizations. In addition to its serious health consequences, obesity has real economic costs that affect all of us. The estimated annual health care cost of obesity-related illness is $190.2 billion, or nearly 21% of annual medical spending in the United States. The cost to the state of Minnesota for all obesity-related medical complication includes costs for diabetes with all of its complications, hypertension, high cholesterol, vascular disease, coronary artery disease, sleep apnea, many cancers, degenerative arthritis, including joint replacements, stroke, infertility, and many others. Weight loss reduces lifetime health care costs. Using claims data for 2.1 million beneficiaries in the federal government in 2008, there were 857,200 patients with overweight and 521,800 patients with obesity, all aged 18 to 64 years. Among federal beneficiaries who have overweight or obesity, lifetime expenditures decline $440, 3% discount rate, for each permanent 1% reduction in body weight. The long-term benefits for weight loss are substantially greater than the short-term benefits. It makes both scientific sense and fiscal sense for Minnesota to lead the way in mainstreaming the treatment of obesity. Beyond bariatric surgery, which should be reserved for patients who have an extreme burden of disease and access to medical nutrition therapy and healthcare professional visits to assess the severity of the disease, medication to help weight loss must be included in our state's coverage. To this end, Minnesota Statute 256B.0625 Covered Services, Subdivision 13D, Drug Formulary, should be amended to remove the language that excludes obesity medication coverage by the state of Minnesota.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Bernardi. You have a testifier. Could you please introduce yourself and then proceed
with your testimony? Yes, I am Rebecca Gonzalez-Campoy, Chief Operating Officer for the Minnesota Center for Obesity, Metabolism, and Endocrinology, also known, obviously, as MINCOM, much shorter. Our medical center has provided obesity care to Minnesotans since 2003. I'm delighted to be here to offer our perspective on obesity as a disease and the need to treat it. The accumulation of excess fat mass leads to a myriad of physical, metabolic, and psychological changes that take away the health of affected individuals. As an organization, in addition to defining bariatric endocrinology and providing excellent patient care, MNCHM is also involved in clinical research and advocacy for our patients. There is now universal agreement that obesity is a chronic disease and that it should be treated like any other chronic disease, as is the case with diabetes, hypertension, AIDS, heart failure, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, arterial sclerosis, and other lifelong diseases. Obesity can be managed, treated, or controlled. Obesity may go into remission, but it may not be cured. Medications for weight loss must be an option for every patient with overweight or obesity. There are now 5 medications approved by the Food and Drug Administration to treat overweight or obesity long term. These new medications for weight loss each have very strong data from randomized placebo-controlled trials demonstrating their efficacy in treating obesity. Of the older medications for weight loss, phentermine, which is a stimulant, has now been shown not to be habit-forming, tolerance-building, or addictive. Compared to amphetamines, which are likely to cause withdrawal symptoms if stopped abruptly, phentermine does not. Because it's the cheapest of all medications for weight loss, it's available for as little as $6 a month, it's the most commonly used medication for weight loss. And I'm going to insert here that you think $6 a month is no big deal. Anybody with Medicaid cannot pay cash for prescriptions that are not on the formulary. So we have to send our patients to other pharmacies in which they have no insurance record and say, have them say to the pharmacist, we don't have insurance, so therefore we're going to pay cash for this drug. If they say they've got MA, they can't get it. Phentermine is a medication and one of the newer medications for obesity marketed as Qsymia. Therefore, it's now approved to be by the FDA for indefinite treatment for obesity. The Minnesota statute, which forbids coverage for obesity medications, was put in place at a time when the overuse of amphetamines became an issue. Phentermine and related compounds were inappropriately lumped with the amphetamines because they were stimulants. Unfortunately, the statute did not focus on this medication, but rather became applicable to all weight loss medications. For us in the treatment of patients with overweight and obesity, the foundation of treatment is healthy eating and behavior modification to develop a healthier, more active lifestyle. It is a focus different than diet and exercise. Medications help patients achieve treatment goals. The benchmark for treatment of overweight or obesity is to achieve and maintain at least 5 to 10% weight loss from baseline. For a 240-pound individual, this would be about 12 to 24 pounds. This weight loss is demonstrable improvements in physical, metabolic, and psychological health. Medications play a major role in helping maintain the lost weight off and allowing for further weight loss over time. For many of our patients, medications help achieve the same results as bariatric surgery. I'm here because my family is affected by this disease. My mother had it. My husband has it. The vast majority of our patients at MNCHM have it. There is no doubt that there are historical obstacles that we must overcome as a society to deal with this obesity epidemic. As far as epidemics go, this is a large one. Modifying the statute is a very important step in making Minnesota current in the treatment of overweight and obesity. It will allow many patients access to needed health care, and this update to Minnesota law will have a positive fiscal impact for all of us. Like changing the oil in the car, it is best to be proactive. Treating overweight and obesity will decrease the burden of disease from all of the complications that are caused over the long term if not treated. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 929? Do you have any questions for a member? Chair Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, Representative Bernardi, thanks for your persistence. I know you've been interested in this issue for a very long time, and I'm glad to see that it's been brought forward for us to think about this. I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if we have anybody here. I see nobody else stepped up to testify, but I'd sure like to hear from DHS, you know, that has its preferred drug list and was, you know, working on these issues, if there's any, you know, if they have any opinion on this, because I don't personally know that much about this issue and would really like to hear in this committee from some other voices on it.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Could you please introduce yourself for the record?
Good afternoon. My name is Chad Hope. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Purchasing and Service Delivery at Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I oversee the pharmacy program. Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the question was some background on why these drugs aren't covered and how it fits in.
Well, Chair Leader, thank you. Thank you for coming down. I'm more interested in knowing I think we got some history on it. I'm more interested in whether the department has a position on this. Is this something that, do you agree with the testimony that this is, that it's time to take a look at allowing these bills to be covered for under Medicaid? And, I'm just kind of looking for another, for confirmation or a contradiction, if that's what it is, about this generally, whether we should be paying for these drugs.
I'm sorry, can you repeat your name again?
Chad Hope.
Hope?
Hope, H-O-P-E.
Okay, Deputy Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not able to speak to whether or not the department has a position on whether or not this would be a good idea. I can confirm that federal law does make weight loss drugs one of the category of medications that can be excluded from a Medicaid pharmacy program, and that is what is currently in our state law.
Right. Chair Leadley. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hope, do other states pay for these drugs, as far as you know?
Deputy Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, I know that there are a lot of other states that do not, but whether it's all states do not and some do, that I can't confirm.
Chair Leadley.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. And I think maybe one of our colleagues here might have something to add.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I prescribe these drugs often because obesity is an epidemic in our country. And when used in conjunction with medical therapy, nutritional therapy, exercise, diet, these medicines have really great outcomes, and they really help a lot of people. So I absolutely agree with you. I think they should be covered. And to that point, too, we need to perhaps think about, we shouldn't treat people on MA differently than we treat everybody else, right? So that's another kind of point there. But to the meds specifically, they do help. And if we can get them to more people, again, with nutrition and exercise, we can decrease rates of obesity, which then leads to decreased heart disease, diabetes, and everything that comes with it, cancer. So thank you for bringing this bill.
So I'm going to make a comment here because when Representative Bernardi first shared with me that she wanted to bring this bill, I thought was like, really? And obesity is an epidemic. I mean, it is, when we look at our country and our state, there is a huge problem with obesity. And when you look at those who could be on Medicaid or MA, I think those numbers just goes even higher. And so for me and for one who believe that, we should always try to provide coverage for all and not exclude anyone from coverage or well-being, but it's more like the impact, or does it work? Is it consistent? Or how often do we see these these patients just being a reoccurrent of an issue that never seems to be exactly where they need to be to improve their health? So, Representative Mann, if maybe if you can, talk a little bit about outcomes of patients.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in my personal practice, I don't have data to tell you number-wise, but I can tell you with certainty I've never had one bad outcome by using these medications. I've never had a side effect significant enough that it caused harm to someone. It either works really well or it doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work. But for the people that it works really well on, I mean, they come back to my office 3 months later, 10, 15 pounds lighter. And it gives you that kickstart, that motivation to know that you can do it and then you can continue to do this. And a lot of people lack that, and sometimes that's all these meds do. And we use them for very short amount of time. The FDA only has most of them approved for 3 months. And so in that three-month time, people relearn their habits. They learn that they don't have to eat the entire amount of food on their plate. They can eat half of it and be full. And again, that motivation that the weight is coming off is extraordinary for people to keep their good habits going.
Thank you for that insight. Members, have any other questions? Bonner, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bernardi, I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I think, you know, as the daughter of a nurse of 43 years, one of the things that I think we talk a lot about, and I will tell you in full disclosure that my sister is type 1. My father and grandmother are both type 2. And the reality is that I think we are at a tipping point where a lot of our population is becoming more and more in danger of sliding into that type 2 diabetes category. And I can tell you, as someone who has worked for companies like Optum Insight, some of the work that they do is really looking for how we can improve patient outcomes. And let's be honest, how we can save costs to the system. And when we talk about preventative measures that can kind of stave that off, so to Dr. Mann's point, if we can find a way to walk back some of the severity of these issues and bring those health outcomes back in line before their health deteriorates, in the long run, to the system, as a taxpayer, as someone who has to foot the bill for all of those things too, I have to be honest with you, not only do I want people to be healthier and happier, but I think it just makes good, solid financial sense for us to find a way to do what's right. And I appreciate, Representative Bernardi, you bringing this forward, because I think when we start talking about preventative measures, this is a good step in the right direction. And so I just want to say thank you for that.
Thank you. Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. So the chair renews a motion that House File 926 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Before we call, Representative Bernardi, well, I'm sorry. Did you want to do a closing statement?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank people about this bill. It's gotten bipartisan support, and I personally want to invite everyone to become a part of this. Representative Cleavorn, Mann, Liebling, O'Neill, Schumacher, Lyndon Carlson, Nelson, Gomez, Hornstein have all signed on already, and I haven't even had a chance to ask people. And Senator Jensen and Senator Klein are carrying it in the Senate. So I really appreciate your support, and this preventative measure that helps save costs, helps save lives, and really treats all Minnesotans fairly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sounds like a good bipartisan bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all in favor of my motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and House File 926 is recommended for a re-referral to the Committees on Ways and Means. Thank you so much. Okay, Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair.
Aye. Representative Edelson, would you like to?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 819 be recommended for placement on the General Register.
All right. Please proceed, Representative Edelson.
And Madam Chair, just before I start, I would also like to move the DE author amendment that I provided to the committee.
Okay, Representative Ellison moves the DE1 office amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Ellison, please present your bill.
Madam Chair, members, House File 819 clarifies existing regulations and aligns current law with clinical care practices related to the use of fluoroscopy in our hospital's cardiac cath labs. This legislation allows cardiovascular technologists, also called CVTs, who have met their specified educational requirements to assist cardiologists with adjusting but not activating fluoroscopy equipment consistent with their training. Fluoroscopy is the process of capturing live images. A CVT's role is to move the patient's table or the arm of the fluoroscopy equipment to make other adjustments as directed by the cardiologist, who has both hands fully occupied managing the incredibly complex and delicate procedure. I want to emphasize that under current practice and made explicitly clear in this bill, CVTs do not step on the pedal that activates the fluoroscopy equipment and actually exposes the patient to radiation. That is done by the doctor. Minnesota's hospitals and cardiologists have long relied on CVTs with the relevant training and expertise specified to the cardiovascular system to perform these operations. In recent years, the Minnesota Department of Health articulated its interpretation of current law in a manner that would restrict assisting cardiologists with fluoroscopy equipment to other professionals who might have the training in general, but generally do not have the specific training that CVTs have regarding the cardiovascular system and the procedures done in the cath lab. Fortunately, hospitals and the department work together to put in place a temporary variance, which is actually coming up to expire, under the department's authority to provide time for the legislature to clarify these statutes. House Bill 819 provides the clarification requested. Several stakeholders, including the Hospital Association, the Minnesota Department of Health, have worked on crafting and reviewing, ultimately agreeing on language before you today. If House Bill 819 is not enacted this year, as I said, the hospital's current variances will expire, threatening access to life-saving care for Minnesotans across the state. Thank you for your consideration, and I hope you'll join me in support of 819, and I'd like to move to my first testifier, Madam Chair.
Yes, please. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee members. My name is Ganesh Ravindran. I'm an interventional cardiologist at the University of Minnesota. As the director of the Cardiac Catheterization Laboratory, I am grateful for this opportunity to share my support for House File 819. Cardiovascular technologists, also called as CVTs, are highly specialized techs who receive extensive training specific to cardiovascular system and cath lab procedures. This deep knowledge of cardiovascular anatomy and specific procedures make them critical partners for cardiologists and the interventional cardiologist of performing procedures in the cath lab. A CVTS expertise is incredibly important for fluoroscopy and imaging studies of moving body structures. This bill will bring state statutory language into alignment with the long-standing clinical practice, ensuring that the Minnesota's cath lab are able to continue providing the highest level of care for our patients. It will be clarified that the CVTs can move, adjust the fluoroscopy equipment under the constant direct supervision of the cardiologist. I want to be clear that this does not mean the CVTs today or would in the future activate the fluoroscopy. Only the cardiologist can actually step on the pedal and deliver the radiation. But the CVTs is a crucial partner for us to performing the procedures. The CVTs stand shoulder to shoulder with me in the cath lab to make adjustments to the equipment so I see precisely the images I want to see. We are committed to radiation safety in everything we do, and we are proud of our safety record on this issue. As a cardiologist, I want the cardiovascular technologists on my side to provide the best, safest care possible. And this bill will ensure CVTs remain as an integral part of the cath lab team. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Can we have our next testifier?
Yes.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Raymond Dent Underwood. I'm the director of the Cardiac Electrophysiology Lab here at United Hospital in St. Paul. And I wanted to testify in support of this House File 819 as well. As it was stated, it brings statutory language into alignment with what's been our longstanding clinical practices. Cath labs and EP labs have been operating with CVTs without any known patient safety incidents for a number of years. We're doing delicate, complicated heart procedures that have a number of risks, including radiation, but many beyond that. And as a cardiac electrophysiologist, I can do my job best if I have a CVT who's specifically trained in that field standing next to me, assisting me with it. The cardiologists in our practice at United are unanimously in support of this legislation, and we've provided a letter signed by the lead physicians at United from the lab supporting that in your packets. We are facing this sense of urgency with the variants potentially that had been given by the Department of Health expiring this summer, and without that, we are going to have a much greater difficult time in the lab. So, again, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 819.
All right. Thank you so much. Scott Hagloom?
Actually, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to say we're going to skip Matt Anderson for now.
Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. Could you please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Indeed. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Hagland. I am a current registered radiologic technologist, a radiography educator, and the program director of radiography at St. Catherine University. And as president of the Minnesota Society of Radiologic Technologists, I comment in favor of the current articulation of this bill today. I would like to acknowledge that I understand that MHA's intent with this bill is not to expand the CBT role or reduce the registered radiologic technologist role in cath lab procedures as they have done and are doing today. I understand that it is not the intent of MHA in this bill to preclude registered radiologic technologists from performing these same activities as CBTs. I would be remiss, however, if I did not take a moment to make an advocacy statement to strengthen the role and the scope of practice of a registered radiologic technologist in the state of Minnesota, in that this type of limited X-ray machine operator practice only does perpetuate a scope of practice creep in radiography, and that it perpetuates the occurrences and inadequacies of other disciplines trying to perform the roles, responsibilities, and duties of a registered radiologic technologist. In summary, I do support the bill as it is written today, even though I do have concerns of this statute overall as it's stated.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Representative Edison, do you have any other testifiers?
Madam Chair, I do not.
Okay, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 819? Okay. Any discussion from committee members? There being no Representative Pearson?
Well, did we move the DE one?
Yes, we did.
Would like a quick description of the change in language then between the DE-1 and the original bill.
Okay, Representative.
Why the change was made.
Edison, are you able to run through that?
We have been working on this, so I'm going to actually call up Matt Anderson, is here from the Hospital Association, to really be able to explain this in more detail.
Okay. Please introduce yourself again and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Anderson. I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We have been working with the Minnesota Department of Health and other stakeholders on this language actually since last legislative session, so it's gone through many iterations. As it was introduced, it had a more limited scope of what kind of education would be eligible to become a CVT. So we added, in addition to what was in the original bill, we added graduates of a accredited CBT program, which is what most CBTs practicing in Minnesota today, where they got their education. So it brings them in. The other thing is that it structurally, we changed the structure of it so that it's more clear to distinguish between these are the activities a CBT can do, and then in the next subdivision, these are the things a CBT can't do, to make the in an attempt to make the language more clear.
Representative Pearson.
And again, just looking at the specifics of the language, in the DE-1, are you saying that we're including everything that's in the underlying, in the original House File 819 with the DE1, we're simply adding this very specific Commission on Accreditation and Allied Health Education Programs? Because it almost, as I read this, it seems like that's the only program. And again, I'm probably reading it wrong because I'm just skimming through it quickly here. So if you, I just want to make sure that we're not going the other direction where we narrowed it. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the DE amendment allows for essentially three paths to become a CVT. One is to become a registered cardiovascular invasive specialist. Two is a registered cardiac electrophysiology specialist. And the third is to graduate from a education program accredited by the Commission of Accreditation on Allied Health Education Programs, which would be a CBT education program. So if you have one of those three credentials and you meet the Department of Health's other requirements that would apply to anybody else in radiation safety measures, you are eligible to be a CBT. The fourth option is to grandfather in those who are currently practicing under a variance. These are people that have already, in getting the variance, screened by the Minnesota Department of Health, taken a test administered by the Minnesota Department of Health to ensure that they can provide safe care to the patients. Those people we want to be able to make sure can continue to practice without having to have a gap in their licensure or in their accreditation or in the patient care that they're able to provide.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only inconsistency within the language then is from the original amendment. It lists two of those items that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then there's language in there that says, and have completed and maintained fluoroscopy safety education and training requirements established by the commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
That's no longer an available option under the DE1. Is that correct, Madam Chair?
Representative Anderson? I mean, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Demote him.
You're selected.
Well, you know, it's no easier than what the rest of you had to do. So you're right. That language was taken out in discussions with the Minnesota Department of Health and other stakeholders. The Department of Health is currently going through a rulemaking process to define what ongoing education and training requirements will be. And so there was a sense of wanting to allow for that rulemaking process to move forward so that it defines the ongoing training and education for all professions, not just CVTs. So we didn't want to create the impression, sort of an unintended consequence, of saying CVTs need to get ongoing education and therefore implying that nobody else does because it's not stated in their statutes.
Representative Pearson.
That's sufficient for me, and I guess almost as like public notice that I want to make sure everyone's part of that discussion and understands what the DE1 does. So appreciate the clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Do you have any further questions? Okay. There have been no further discussion. Representative Edison renews her motion that House File 819, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 819, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you so much. Okay, Representative Anderson, House File 910.
Madam Chair?
Would you like to move this bill?
Yes, I would. Madam Chair, I would move this House File 910 to be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations.
Okay, we have the bill before the committee. Representative Edison, would you also like to move your author's amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the reminder. Yes, I would like to move my author's amendment.
Representative Edison moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Edison, please present your bill.
Madam Chair and members, since 2007, the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee has brought professionals, parents, and advocates together to advise the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Department of Education on how to monitor progress and continuously improve the early hearing detection and intervention system. The committee designs protocols for tracking children from birth through age 3 that may have passed newborn screening but are at risk for delayed or late onset of permanent hearing loss. They design a technical assistance program to support hospitals, birthing centers, and other facilities on conducting rescreening and diagnostic audiological assessments. They figure out implementation and evaluation of a system of follow-up and tracking. And they also evaluate program outcomes to increase effectiveness and efficiency and ensure culturally appropriate services for children with confirmed hearing loss and for their families. Hearing loss is one of the most prevalent conditions that can be identified at birth. Before we had a newborn hearing screening mandated, screening mandate and advisory committee. Minnesota was in the bottom 5 states in the country in our identification and reporting of hearing loss in the CDC. Now we are in the top 5. You have before you a list of the most recent protocols that have been developed by the advisory committee. This bill is a renewal of the role of the committee, and it also adds a representative from the Deaf Mentor Program. It also adds a representative from the State Academy for the Deaf from the Minnesota State Academy's board. With that, members, I would like to move to my first testifier.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the records and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to thank you for taking the time today to hear us. My name is Laura Godfrey, and I am a parent of a child who has a hearing loss. I am also the manager of Minnesota Hands and Voices, which is a parent-to-parent support organization supporting families who have children that are diagnosed with a confirmed hearing loss. And I am currently the co-chair of the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. So thank you, Representative Edelson, for introducing House File 910. Today we're asking for the renewal of the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. When my son was born, the average age of identification of a child with a hearing loss was 3.5 years old. Because of the work of this committee, babies get a diagnosis of hearing loss from a medical provider at close to 3 months. Since 2007, the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee has brought together professionals, parents, and advocates that have a stake in improving the early hearing detection and intervention systems, otherwise known as EDI. They wouldn't all be in the same room if we didn't have the committee. We learn from each other and monitor and continuously improve the system. Because of our work, Minnesota has one of the best systems in the country. Because of it, we have strong standards and policies. The work of the committee needs to continue. From 2017 to 2018, the committee made a few recommendations to follow protocols to the Department of Health, some of which were medical guidelines were updated, revised guidelines for hearing screening after the newborn period to kindergarten age, audiological assessment guidelines were updated, and the committee is currently begun work to review and revise the 2008 guidelines for pediatric amplification and the 2009 guidelines for audiologists to refer to early intervention and family-to-family support. We have more work to do. The system isn't perfect, but we're getting there. The committee is required to provide an update every 2 years, which provides transparency and accountability. I urge you to vote to continue to support this important piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I believe you have another testifier.
Madam Chair, my next testifier is.
Hello.
Okay, could we?
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Danelle Granaris, and I am the manager of the Deaf Mentor Family Program at LifeTrack. This amendment adds deaf mentors to the advisory board, and I am here to explain why that is critical. The Deaf Mentor Family Program focuses on the communication needs of families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing from birth to age 6. The Deaf Mentor Family Program assists these families by providing instruction in American Sign Language, early visual communication methods, and deaf culture. This is done through trained deaf mentors who are deaf or hard of hearing, and it takes place at the family's home and in their home environment. Deaf mentors have been chosen based on their fluency in American Sign Language, their ability to communicate easily with hearing family members, their comfort with young children, and their ability to support families' decisions. The deaf mentor sessions are provided to a family with deaf or hard of hearing children for up to 2 hours for a period of 2 years so the families can learn American Sign Language. When this bill was passed in 2007, there was a small grant program, and now deaf mentors are written into statute as part of the EDDIE system. Adding deaf mentors to the advisory committee would strengthen this monitoring and tracking and the process that we have in place, as well as adding visual language acquisition. The advisory committee could add guidelines for visual language acquisition. Because of the changes that were made in the federal EDDIE reauthorization law, the federal funder for state EDDIE systems, HRSA, will add reporting requirements for visual language acquisition. Minnesota is ahead of the game because we have funding mechanisms in place that cover the cost and support the system that's in place. These need to be integrated into the system and made part of the advisory committee. I urge you to pass this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Representative Edison, do you have any other testifiers?
Madam Chair, I do not.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 910? Is there any discussion from members? There being no further discussion, Representative Edison renews a motion that House File 910, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say I want to thank Representative Pearson. I think you're the co-author on this, and so just I wanted to thank him for that.
Okay, thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. House File 910, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you so much. And as we can see, this is Representative Edison's day. So we have House File 814. Representative Edison, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 814 to be recommended for re-referral to the Committee of Ways and Means.
Thank you so much, members. We have the bill before us. Would you please present your bill?
Madam Chair and members, I am honored to present the third bill today. I'm honored to present the School Links Mental Health Expansion Bill before you today. These grants came out of a multi-year, multi-stakeholder group called the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group. They recognize the barriers faced by families in accessing treatment for their children, including time, transportation, navigating the system, and more. On top of that, they heard from families that often the schools didn't know how to support their children in the classroom. The bill was passed in 2007 with funding going out the door in 2008. The grant money goes to community mental health providers who then co-locate in schools. Grant funds are used to treat children who are uninsured or underinsured and to work with school support personnel and teachers to support children in the classroom. The provider bills, private and public insurance, and the mental health records are kept separate from the educational records. The provider can also provide care when the school is not in session. It's important to note that this program builds on the work that school support personnel perform in the schools. We need both. It's been a very popular and effective program. In 2017, 16,284 children were provided treatment. In 2019, services will be available in 953 school buildings, 46% across 288 school districts, 52%. It has eliminated barriers and addressed equity issues as well. In 2017, the legislature also provided $4.9 million for a more intensive program in the intermediate districts and special education co-ops so that they could develop more therapeutic teaching models to support children who have the intense and high complex needs. We are not yet meeting the needs of all of our children. We know the crisis we are facing with children's mental health, and we must come together to address it. This year's bill, House File 1557, does several things. It provides more clarity in statute about the grants. There is more flexibility as to who can apply for the grants, including a small clinic that has at least two FTEs, mental health professionals, which can help in rural areas. It clarifies the use of grant money, including covering the cost of telemedicine, building the capacity of our schools to meet the needs of our students. Let's see here. These would be expanded to districts with federal instructional level for classrooms. Last, we would like to, like the Commissioner of Human Services and Education, to bring people together to talk about where we have been these past 10 years and where we need to go in the future. We've left open the appropriation sections, but would like to see at least $5 million a year added to this program. The school-linked mental health program is effective and is proven to help students. I'm honored to report the governor included also the school-linked mental health in his budget this year. Madam Chair, I'm ready to move to my testifiers.
Okay. Representative Edison, I just must ask. I thought I heard you say House File 117.
Oh, did I? Madam Chair, yeah, I think I did that. Okay. Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. Okay. I've had six bills today. I apologize.
So we do mean House File 814, correct? Yes. I think it's all right. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and thank you, Representative Ellison, for carrying this bill. You know, as all of you know, we have an increase in the prevalence of children who are experiencing mental health symptoms. For many years, it's been one in five, and it's starting to become more, and so it's become a real crisis in our system. This program, as you know, is really widely supported. You have a packet of emails and letters that were sent just within the last 3 days without even just really actually just putting up on Facebook, and they started to come in. So everyone really loves this program. What we see over and over again is that we actually reach children who have never received treatment before, and this is particularly true for children of color. It's shown greater treatment completion rates, and it's shown decreased suspension and increase in engagement in school. And most importantly, students get better. One of the main things I want to point out about this year's bill is we're asking for a review of the program. After 10 years, we think that we've learned a lot, and it's now time to look at it to see if we can do better. An important provision is to examine how we can make the program more sustainable at the local level. By making these very competitive grants, I feel like we're rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, once a program receives a grant and they're doing well, let's keep the money there and use new money to expand to new schools and new districts. Otherwise, we end up upending the relationships between schools and providers and, frankly, even with the staff. The other issue we need to look at is, should we stretch the dollars as far as we can go? What is the most effective FTE per number of pupils in the school to make sure, frankly, that the percentage isn't so small that the mental health professional cannot work to build the capacity of the entire school to support students who are struggling with their mental health? Because if we stretch them very far, we won't have the Minnesota model. It's also time to look at the data collected. Are there other things that we should be looking at, such as suspension rates or parental satisfaction or even engagement with the school? And lastly, let's look at what happens when we have the multi-tiered systems of support like positive behavior intervention services and school support personnel and school-linked mental health. Are the outcomes significantly better? We have greatly appreciated the bipartisan support this program has received over the years. There is almost always a small increase, except for in 2013 when there was a 100% increase. But let's do a larger increase this year and really tackle the mental health crisis facing our students in Minnesota. You know, as I've always said, we know exactly what we need to do. Let's just do it. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Adam Holden, I have a question for you. In communities of color, using the words mental health is not always received in a positive way that parents want to engage. Is there other language, if any, that has been used to really, especially when you're looking at kids under 18 or up to 18, any other language we're using to really bring in diverse populations of individuals, families?
Madam Chair, because of the change that the legislature actually made, I think it was last year, providers can do a brief diagnostic assessment and provide, I think it's 3 or 4 therapy sessions without naming it, which we think is really important because especially in communities of colors, especially with refugee communities, you need to establish a relationship with that family before you can even start talking about these issues. The other thing that we've seen, though, just within our own office and doing outreach to various communities is that often families are more open to talking about it when it's their child than when it's themselves. And so when they see their child struggling, when they see them not doing well in school, when they see them not wanting to go to school, they really want to get to the bottom of it, and so they're more likely actually to reach out. And what we have seen, especially in the data in with Minneapolis, is that we have a much higher percentage of students of color who are actually receiving treatment than before.
But thank you for this. I also, along with you, I've seen a great increase in young people who are just really struggling.
Yeah.
So thank you. We have our next testifier is Jennifer Burstrom.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Bertram, and I'm here today to talk about my gratitude for the schooling to mental health providers in Minnesota. As a parent to a fourth grade daughter who benefits from these services in ISD 271 Bloomington, and I really am thankful and express my support for expanding this important program. I have two daughters who've been identified as twice exceptional, or what's known as 2E, a sixth grader and a fourth grader, both in the Bloomington School District in their Dimensions Academy Gifted program. The term is used to describe people who qualify as gifted intellectually, but who also have a learning or developmental disability. And so these are tricky children to educate and treat. My older daughter has autism and generalized anxiety. My younger daughter has ADHD along with some depression. And both girls were transferred to Bloomington's gifted program in 2017 after we determined that our neighborhood school couldn't provide the services and supports that they needed for their mental health and neurodevelopmental challenges. My girl's father and I divorced about 3 years ago, and that adjustment to having divorced parents along with moving between two homes and then not long after the adjustment to starting new school was overwhelming to both of my daughters. Transitions are often hard for these girls anyway, given their challenges, but these twin challenges were especially hard to cope with. My older daughter has seen a therapist for many years privately to support her social-emotional learning, but that therapist has a policy for not seeing siblings. She also decided in early 2018 to stop accepting insurance, so our weekly appointments had to be cut back to monthly, disrupting her progress, but a necessary step, unfortunately, for our family budget. I knew my younger daughter needed therapy as well and found a private therapist who, unfortunately, shortly after she began appointments, discontinued taking the insurance that we had, and she moved her office further away from our home, and it made it really challenging to be able to use her services. We found another person who also soon thereafter stopped taking insurance. We've found that several therapists struggle with the paperwork and the challenges with accepting insurance, and due to high demand, they're able to require private pay, which is challenging for our family. Another therapy group had a long waiting list. They offered my daughter midday Wednesday appointments, but I can't spend that too much time transporting her to and from that appointment and taking her away from her learning at school. So we really didn't have many options for my daughter, who was struggling and withdrawing and having real challenges at school. So last year, I got to know the school social worker pretty well, and she provided some support to both of my daughters as much as she could, but she had many other issues to deal with as the school social worker. But thankfully, at the beginning of this school year, this social worker let me know that the school-linked mental health provider had an opening for my fourth-grade daughter. She said that was very rare, but she happened to have an opening. She works for Washburn Child Guidance Center and meets with my daughter weekly at school on a set of four goals that are determined in cooperation with parental and teacher input. Every 6 weeks or so, I get to meet with her to determine how her progress is going on goals and set new targets for improvement. My daughter has had a challenging situation with another student in her class this year that was able to be addressed through this provider, and the provider is also familiar with the teachers and can troubleshoot relationships between my daughter and her teachers and suggest changes that can improve my daughter's focus and learning with suggestions to address her needs related to her ADHD. We pay a copay through our insurance for this service, and that's worth every penny to me. My daughter looks forward to Mondays when she can see Miss Dana, and I see her mood beginning to improve. I'm very thankful for this service, and I know there are many more children that would benefit from having a therapist at school to improve the understanding of the needs of the whole child and support their learning and educational outcomes. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for coming to testify. It makes a difference. Don Omarosi? And why don't we also have Sandra Lewandowski? Lewandowski. Sandra? Oh, okay, thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Don Amorosi. On July 13th, 2019, my 16-year-old son was killed by deputies as a result of a 911 mental health call, crisis call from his mother. Since that time, I've pledged to find out what could have been done differently anywhere, anytime. I can't bring him back, but God willing, I can be the voice that saves others' equally precious lives. I'm grateful that you are listening to my voice now. I've looked under every rock imaginable for answers, solutions, and hope. Being here makes me hopeful. On this nightmare of a journey, I've spent many hours with Minnetonka school officials and staff and learned a great deal. My son was a popular, bright, kind young man with many gifts. He attended Minnetonka Public Schools from 3rd grade to 10th grade and would be a junior now. What I learned is that even the very best schools are behind, way behind, when it comes to mental health care and support, and we have to catch up. We did this to our kids, and we owe them solutions that they don't even know they need. We've given our kids cell phones and social media, computer-based learning, and reality TV. We've overcrowded their schedules with activities and responsibility while placing extremely high expectations on academic, artistic, and athletic achievement. We pay so much attention to all these things, and yet not their mental health. And not enough time just letting them be happy. Our experience is that once we overcame our insurance company's ability to dodge mental health parity and found a therapist or psychiatrist, we still had to contend with our son's fear of losing his job as quarterback or anxiety over missing an assignment which could only be made up at 7 a.m. before school, or even truancy, something that in this day and age shows up on a parent's phone the minute they miss a class. You see, we must bring health care, mental health care, to our kids where it works for them in the schools. My son spent as much as 12 hours a day at school during the week. There is no other time. Just like we did with our nurses 100 years ago, and just like we do with lunchrooms today, they're in our schools. Otherwise, doing it another way, we're just kidding ourselves. What little access to mental health care we have in schools today is simply not enough, not even close. The 2016 Minnetonka survey students showed our administrators that 11% of 11th grade males and 27% of females reported long-term behavioral or emotional problems. double these percentage, I mean literally double those percentages, and you have the number of Minnetonka skippers who reported they felt down, depressed, or hopeless, 2 to 3.5 times per week, days per week. My son had extreme anxiety, depression, and ADHD, which landed him in the principal's office at every school, elementary, middle, high school. I knew every teacher, every counselor. At times he was suspended. He was almost expelled from the school entirely. And with that goes a tremendous amount of humiliation, being a kid and being disciplined like that. Almost as much humiliation as comes with having to get up and leave a classroom and tell everybody, make up some story about where you're going to counseling. So I was right there with him. And never once, and never once was there any sort of help offered. Now, I've put 4 kids through the Minnetonka school system, and I've never heard of school-linked mental health until after I started digging and after my son was killed. Keep in mind, I'm talking about a school that, by my math, is able to provide mental health, school-linked mental health resources for 1% of its student population. Compare that to the 27% that say they need it. Funding school-linked mental health at the level proposed is urgently necessary, and it's still not enough. So if I could, I know I'm mixing commissions a little bit here, but the other side of this coin to me, from my learning, is that the data and information that comes with this funding and the expectation that it will be reported is crucial. If you look on our school's website, you'll know every statistic there is. Our average ACT score is 27.7. You can compare our reading scores to those kids in Singapore, but there is not one measure anywhere in the 62-page annual report that suggests how Minnetonka is doing as a school when it comes to mental health. The data is rich, it's useful, and even more useful if it can be shaped and wielded into information for we as parents. I do very much thank you for your time.
And thank you for your testimony. And of course, sorry for your loss. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandra Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287. We serve 11 member districts on the west side of the suburban metropolitan area, and I also represent 4 intermediate school districts in Minnesota. As an intermediate school district in Hennepin County, my school serves nearly 1,000 of the highest needs students in this county. And nearly all of these students have severe and persistent mental health conditions, are identified as having multiple medical diagnoses, and numerous behavioral disorders. Most have experienced complex developmental and racial trauma. In their short lives, they've suffered great pain and deserve compassion and the best therapeutic treatment possible. Yet often they are in the classrooms of special education programs in our intermediate districts without access to that treatment. School districts like mine have become the front line of the children's mental health system. I testify here today that public schools cannot sustain this effort without more help. We were never designed to provide the equivalent of residential treatment services. Furthermore, lack of clear policy and sustained funding have put my staff at great risk, and I can no longer ensure their safety on any given day. The schools in my district have students in acute mental health crises every single day. Like a recent situation where a young girl under 10 arrived at school the day after she had been sexually assaulted. She came to school with broken shards of glass in her pocket, intending to harm herself that day. She bolted into the street to throw herself into traffic. She made homicidal and suicidal threats. That's what the front line looks like in my school district. Or the adolescent girl I learned of just this morning who is so actively suicidal that she arrived this week with rope marks on her neck. Or then another failed attempt that had taken place last night. Or the classmate that arrived this morning with significant delusional behavior, and yet we could not convince the ambulance driver to transport her to the hospital without further explicit evidence. Mm-hmm.
It's also important that I share the racial equity disparities that I see in our care and treatment programs for which we provide educational services. What our data shows that is if you're black or brown, you're six times more likely to be directed toward correctional programs rather than mental health treatment programs. Our efforts to interrupt this pipeline to prison are fortunately seen in our current innovative mental health grant that the legislature funded for 2 years. In that program for K-2 students in our special education division, we're providing an intensive school-based therapeutic teaching model in partnership with the Amherst Wilder Foundation. Right now, all the students who have been referred to that program are young boys of color. If this program were not provided in our school, these little boys would not have access to treatment through the traditional insurance channels. There are simply too many barriers for them to get any kind of treatment, much less an intensive treatment. It is my hope that with this intensive therapeutic program will change the trajectory of these young children and their families. Members of the committee, the time has come for full funding of school-linked mental health grants, and the intermediates are pleased to work with NAMI on House File 814 that will help address the needs of these children that come to intermediate school districts in our state. I implore you to consider this bill as a top funding priority. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony and your insight into what's happening in our school system. I appreciate it. Sandra Rittenmeyer? Clean it up for me. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shauna Reitmeyer, and I am the Chief Executive Officer for the Northwestern Mental Health Center located in Crookston. The Northwestern Mental Health Center serves 8 Northwest rural frontier counties through the school-linked mental health grant in over 25 school districts, which include 36 buildings. In our last round of funding through the School Link grant, we impacted over 923 lives of children by providing assessment, intervention, treatment, coordination, and outreach to children and families. Along with the direct services we provide, we have also been able to provide training and supervision to expand the expertise and competency of existing district staff to increase access to mental health services, along with training hundreds of faculty within our region to have more awareness and detect early signs of mental illness. This model of service delivery, especially in rural frontier areas like mine, increased the access to key services that support them in their natural environment. Families do not need to take time off from work in order to transport their child to a clinic, and in our area, that could be a 1-hour drive one way. And children will also not have to leave school and increase their stress on how they will make up that missed work. Additionally, the grants are a key safety net allowing services to be provided to children who are underinsured or uninsured. This allows the child to be more fully integrated in their classroom, academics improve, and early detection and intervention can prevent a mental health condition from becoming a serious mental illness that could lead to being debilitating for some into adulthood. Lastly, school-based services is the conduit for accessing other potentially necessary services such as psychiatry, case management, or in-home services for children and their family. Because of the benefits these grants have provided our region for over 18 years, I urge you to support Representative Edelson's House File 814 to increase funding and ensure quality of these services. So thank you for your leadership and for your time in considering this bill.
And thank you so much for your testimony. Eric Pingree? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eric Pingree. I'm the superintendent of Walker Hackensack Akeley. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you in reference to this. Our school district is a normal small school district in rural Minnesota. We're outstate, and I speak on behalf of our district as well as many superintendents in outstate. Prevalent conversation that we have is the mental health and all. In addition to that, the early onset of some of the situations we're seeing, we're not only dealing with kindergarten, first grade, second grade, we're dealing with parents who are struggling with mental health issues and raising students with mental health issues. This is a phenomenal opportunity. We take advantage of the SchoolLink mental health grants, and we appreciate that. We serve an underserved population that previously would not get service, but I implore you to look into expanding this, not only the schools that currently use parts of it, but there's a lot of school districts that aren't available to tap into this but still have such a need. Our mental health workers provide group, individual, crisis counseling. They do home visits. They connect some of the community to the school. And some situations arise where the school is not the favorite of the parent, but yet it's an outside agency that can connect and build those relationships and ultimately keeping kids in school and also keeping kids out of the system. I just want to say I appreciate it, and a lot of my notes are redundant and repetitious of previous people, but I'd like to really stress the point that many superintendents in outstate and rural communities appreciate this and implore you to look into expanding it to cover all of our students because this is such an issue. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Okay, that is our last scheduled testifier. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 814? Members, do you have any questions? Chair Liebman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I wonder if Ms. Abderholden could come back. Thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this bill. And I have been a big supporter of this program and continue to be, but I just have some questions about the bill language. And I know, Ms. Abderholden, you mentioned that you were making changes, and as I'm reading the bill, I see there's a lot of new language, and I just want to make sure that I understand how the program's being changed. And I wonder if you could just address that so we all understand it as we go forward here.
Mrs. Abderholden.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. So there's a change on, really it doesn't even start until page 3, where we're listing out who the eligible applicants are, and I know that this language has been is fine with the Department of Human Services as well. We especially wanted to make sure that in rural areas where you don't necessarily have a children's therapeutic services and support provider, that perhaps you have a primary clinic that has two therapists. They could then actually collaborate with the school. So this should broaden, frankly, the number of people who can be providing SchoolLink to mental health. So that's the first big one. The second one is it was never really laid out in statute about what the allowable grant activities are. So making sure that it includes, and that's the bottom of page 3, identifying and diagnosing mental health conditions, delivering the treatment, supporting the family, providing transportation, especially during summer months when school's not in session, but you still want those children to access treatment. Making clear that we want to build the capacity of the entire school to support children, not just the therapy. It can also be used for telemedicine. So in some of the rural areas where you can't get someone necessarily, or it's really not a good use of your resources to have a therapist, you know, driving tons of miles, you could do telemedicine there as well. The specialized grants is from last year, or 2 years ago, rather, for the intermediate districts. And then in the bottom of page 4 and onto 5 is really asking the Department of Human Services to kind of talk to the stakeholders and look at some of these issues now that we've had the program in place 10 years to see what we could come to an agreement for the future. Does that cover your questions?
Yeah. Jeremy. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do we have Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edelson, I'd like to take you to page 3 of your bill. Under section 3, section 2, subdivision 3. And in a number of cases where you lay out the provisions for the activities, I find it not troublesome but unique that we don't have the colon after the word include versus enabling but are not limited to. And so I'm wondering if you would be willing to expand your thoughts in terms of if this list is not complete, what wouldn't be included that you're thinking about with regard to why are you including but are not limited to under that header?
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Abdahol.
Madam Chair, Representative, we just want to make sure we don't forget anything, but, you know, certainly I think it's a pretty exhaustive list.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edelson, under Section 2 on SAME, the establishment, so it says the Commissioner of Human Services shall establish a school-linked mental health grant program, and then you enumerate the elder applicants and whatnot, and then on page 4, you go on to talk about under Section 3, lines 4.25 through 4.29, are you creating a commission here or just a collaboration between the agencies themselves? Because to the way I read it, it could be one or both.
Representative,
we didn't want to create a task force because we know then all the rigmarole that you have to go through for that. So knowing that we need the Commissioner of Education and the Commissioner of Human Services to talk together, especially when we're looking at the impact of school support personnel and those kinds of things, but we also wanted them to make sure that they talk to the stakeholders to make sure that they get the input from, you know, both the providers and, you know, the principals and things like that. So we're not asking for something that's as formal as a task force, but wanting them to say, let's go look at these kinds of issues since we've had the program for 10 years.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abdahol, then, would it be my impression that each agency commissioner would have one person, one vote, and they are making recommendations to the commissioner of DHS, or is it a prioritization list of some sorts, or are they just at the discretion of the commissioner of DHS to respond to his or her determination in terms of how these grants are to be awarded?
Mrs. Abdahol.
Madam Chair, Representative, so they couldn't just decide to do it differently because we have more language than we've had before. So they would need to come back. So if for example, they decided they would not necessarily be competitive grants, then they would actually need to come back and say that current providers would continue to get it. Expansion would be to new funding. If there were different data pieces to collect, often the departments actually, you know, without legislation, come up with what are the grant outcomes that you want to see. But I do think a big one, which really does include both the Department of Education and Human Services working together, is what happens when we have the supports that we need in the schools, such as PBIS and school support personnel and SchoolLinked. We need to look at that data together to see does that even have a greater impact than just having one alone in a school building. So there is some collaboration there that would have to take place.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abdahol, are you comfortable with the informality of what you described that isn't included in here that you actually are going to achieve a concerted effort on behalf of everyone, or should there be more structure, more formality to the process, or maybe there's something that I'm not seeing here that's undergirding this that you already have in place?
Mrs. Abdahol.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, I would say that right now, because of the, frankly, good relationships with the both departments, and I think the commitment to making sure that we're addressing children's mental health and that we're using these dollars as efficiently as possible, that I think we can actually do it informal. You know, there are times you seem to hear with other bills where it's a much more formal process because I'm worried about will we be listened to? You know, will the stakeholders really be involved? I'm not really worried about that with this situation. We just really want to say, you know, it's been 10 years. Let's really look at this program and see if there's some things that we should perhaps change.
Madam Chair, final question. And this is, I'm going to throw this one to Ms. Abdahol. you feel free to weigh in on this one, Representative Adelson. It refers to lines 4.3 through 4.6. And just so I and the members are clear in terms of what is inferred by shall obtain all available third-party reimbursement sources as a condition of receiving a grant. A bit nebulous, and for the tape as well as our understanding, what is meant by that?
Mrs. Abdelhogan.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. What it means is that a provider needs to bill private insurance if the family has it, Medicaid, Minnesota Care, which is what actually makes this program sustainable. It's not 100% grant reliant. It's a mixture of funding. Anytime we braid funding, we have a more stable program. And so they are required to bill insurance if the family has it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Adelson, just a final op-ed. Thank you for sponsoring this bill. It's well worth it and worthy of our support. Thank you.
Representative Robin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Adelson, for bringing forth this bill. I share the concerns about the lack of opportunity for mental health in the schools, and so I think it's wonderful. But I do have a quick question. I have the privilege of serving on the Civil Law Committee as well, and so we've had a lot of discussion over the last few weeks about data. So I wondered if you could just tell me more about Subdivision 4, who will have access to the data besides the commissioner, and what types of data will be collected for the evaluating the effectiveness of the program?
Mrs. Abdelhogan.
Madam Chair, Representative, so it's not individual data at all. And the beauty of actually this program is that they're not education records, they're health records, so they're governed by HIPAA. So that's kind of the overriding concern about how that data is used. So they would report, for example, the number of children that they served. They would report whether their CAFSI scores increased or not. They would report how the other funding was used. They would report the number of children that had insurance. But it's aggregate data. It's not individual specific.
Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. And secondly, on line 5.3 on page 5, it talks about developing a funding formula that promotes sustainability and consistency across the grant cycles, which was alluded to earlier, just so that schools that already have received funding can continue to provide services, which I appreciate that goal, but how do you balance that with wanting to expand the other opportunities for new schools to participate? So if you could explain more about how long you think a school will participate or what this will actually look like in practice. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, the reality is I think that as we look to services in our schools, this is indefinitely. We want to make sure that we're providing I think we had the dad that spoke to his son needing services. Our students, if you look at the stress ratios in our schools, they're significant, and I don't see that going away because the expectations on our kids continue to rise. And so, you know, the funding source and being able to bill insurance actually helps us here. So honestly, indefinitely. I mean, I don't know when. I think we could, with the group that we're talking about having kind of come up, reevaluate the program, I think that will be helpful in terms of what are we going to do in the next, 10 years.
Okay. So I just want to, before we ask another question, I just want us to know that we have to be out of this room for the Republicans to caucus at 4:15. So if we have more extensive questions, that we have Representative Pearson also asking questions. So I'm thinking that we may have to recess and come back at the call of the chair around 6:45.
Madam, I will be in public safety.
I get
so
that.
I don't know that I, okay.
I'm done. We can talk offline.
Okay. Representative Pearson?
Well, I guess my question's a little bit more to the application end of things and how all the reporting and the data, there's a lot of questions with that. I just feel like in some ways we're having DHS doing evaluations of education, or in the absence of that, that they're going to be giving staffing and recommendations on those types of areas. And in some ways, it's sort of like a crossover. And my real concern ends up being sort of these databases, who's responsible, how it's managed, and how it's all put together, because, you know, our state hasn't had the best track record on some of this database analysis, and having two departments, DHS and education, doing something together just reminds me of MNLARS and MnDOT and Minute and those things just not going well in the past for us. And I really would like just some types of assurances of how this is already working and how it will progress moving forward.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, so there is no database where each individual child is put in. So this isn't what that's about. We've had 10 years of experience of this. So we're able to glean from the outcome reports from the grantees that, for example, we know that almost 50% of the children had never received treatment before, and 50% of them had a very serious mental illness. We've known what percentage of children have had insurance. We've known who refers them. So it's kind of like grant reporting data. It's really not healthcare data, which I think is a very important distinguishing factor. And so the department's not collecting information on individual students at all. That is the provider, which is why we've separated that out. Mm-hmm. It's the mental health provider who is doing that. So we have that data. It's been working fine. I think with any time you're putting out grant funding, you want to see what the outcomes are. And so that's the data that's being reported, not individual children's medical records.
And for clarity, that's been being done through DHS currently?
Yes, for 10 years.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further questions from members? Okay. There have been no further discussion. Representative Edison renews her motion that House File 814 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee of Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 814 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, we are going to recess into the call of the chair. We're looking at maybe around 6:45 or returning to this room. We are in recess. We're calling the Committee of Health and Human Service Policy back to order. Our first bill is House File 840. Representative Lean. Representative Lean, you're up. The chair moves House File 840 to be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Mm-hmm. Members, we have the bill before us. Welcome, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, appreciate you hearing this bill tonight, House File 840. House File 840 would add scaling and root planing back to the list of covered dental services for medical assistance. There are two common dental diseases, and only tooth decay is currently covered by MA. Periodontal disease, more commonly known as gum disease, used to be covered but has not been for 10 years. Excuse me. To give a brief history on the issue, in 2009, when the state was suffering from a budget deficit in the billions, benefits for adults on medical assistance were cut in half, and unfortunately, this included the treatment of gum disease. Periodontal disease is a serious condition that increases costs as it gets worse. Sometimes gum disease needs to be treated first before a patient can undergo any other care, including operations. If gum disease is left untreated, it can lead to requiring treatment for other health problems, as well as hospitalizations. In general, it costs more to leave gum disease untreated than to treat it. We have numerous studies from health insurance companies showing treatment of gum disease actually reduces overall health care costs for patients with a number of chronic health care issues, including heart disease, diabetes, dementia, and others. Because we are not covering the treatment of gum disease, dental and medical costs increase, and Minnesotans are not getting the care they need. With me tonight, I have Dr. Michael Helgeson with Appletree Dental, which is a unique nonprofit dental group that provides care to a large Medicaid population throughout our state, to address the bill and answer any questions you may have. Welcome. Also in your packets, members, are letters of support from Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association and the Minnesota Dental Association.
Welcome, Dr. Helgeson. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you can begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Michael Helgeson. I'm a geriatric and special care dentist, and I'm the CEO of Appletree Dental, which is a nonprofit organization that provided 96,000 dental visits and screenings last year, more than 80% of which were for Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollees, underserved children, adults, frail elders from all across the state. Tonight I'm speaking on behalf of Dental Access Partners, which includes Community Dental Care and HCMC, now called Hennepin Healthcare. Together, our three critical access dental organizations served patients from 85 out of Minnesota's 87 counties, more than 80% of whom were enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs. And in addition to our clinics to reach people facing barriers to care, we also delivered dental services at over 175 sites, ranging from Head Start centers, schools, nursing homes, and other locations. And in fact, during 2016 and 2017, our three organizations alone provided about 14% of all the dental services provided to Minnesota healthcare program recipients. And so if you think about 3,000 to 4,000 licensed dentists in Minnesota, these three organizations really are critical to delivery of care across the state. So tonight, given that there's really broad bipartisan support and a growing understanding of the importance of periodontal disease to overall health, I'm just going to make three quick points tonight, and then I'd welcome your questions. The first is, was mentioned previously, medical assistance only covers one of the two infections in the mouth. Periodontal disease is an infection of the gums and the bone surrounding the teeth caused by a complicated group of pathogens, and left untreated, it spreads, as you heard, and causes other medical problems and complications. So this bill is very simple. It reinstates some basic, essential, first-line treatment for periodontal disease. It's the most cost-effective way to address this problem. Second point I want to make is that left untreated, it spreads, causing negative impacts on overall health, employability, ability to perform in school, diet, self-esteem, and more. So failing to treat the infection early leads inevitably to increased dental disease, increased medical complications, and increased costs. The final point is economic, and it was touched on by Representative Lean. Numerous economic analyses have been completed that show that patients with chronic conditions who do receive periodontal services have significantly lower overall health care costs. One study, heart disease patients treated for periodontal disease saved $1,000 a year. Patients with cerebrovascular disease or stroke had savings that topped $5,000 per person per year. And for diabetics, the savings was more than $2,800 per person per year, which is in one of the handouts. There's over 400,000 people in Minnesota with diabetes, about 10% of the adult population. And the cost for diabetes in Minnesota is estimated at $4.4 billion per year. So doing things that are going to help improve outcomes and costs for diabetics are really critical. So in closing, I encourage all of you to support Health File 840. As was mentioned, the Dental Association, the Dental Hygiene Association, also the Board of Dentistry and numerous other organizations strongly support this bill. It'll reduce disparities, drive down oral health care costs, and improve health. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify, and I would welcome any questions that you may have.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Lean?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 926? I'm sorry, 840? Okay. There been no further discussion? Oh, members, you have any questions?
Yeah.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question. I just want to thank Dr. Helgeson for his work. Thank you, Representative Lean, for carrying the bill. I thank, Dr. Helgeson, for members who have been around for a while. He's been working on these issues for a very long time, and he's done amazing work to actually deliver care to patients in Minnesota in a lot of different settings through AppleTree Dental. And so thank you very much for continuing your work. And, you know, we hope we can do some better work on dental care this session.
Thank you so much, Representative.
Thank you. Any other questions for members? No further discussion. The chair renews a motion that House File 840 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails. House File 840 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much for
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members.
Thank you again.
Okay.
Between Representative Liebling and I, we can take care of it all. Right? We can take care of it.
What's the it in the sentence? That's important. Don't agree to anything.
We have us out of here by 7 o'clock.
The chair moves at House File. Representative Bierman, please come to the table and present your bill. Oh, good, I brought treats. Yeah, the chair moves that House File 1250 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Welcome, Representative Bierman. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I did bring you some dessert there, so help yourself to that. They're kind of small, so if you want to take a couple, that's fine. Thank you for the opportunity to bring House File 1250. House File 1250 will move the Certified Community Behavioral Clinics, or CCBHCs, from a federal demonstration to a sustaining community mental health service delivery model for Minnesotans. CCBHCs are designed as a one-stop shop for clients to receive comprehensive, coordinated, community-based behavioral health service. This is opposed to having to navigate the complexities of our current system being handled by multiple referrals, wait lists, and authorizations. Care coordination is the key to this model. CCBHCs proactively work with partner hospitals, primary medical care, and social service organizations to ensure clients receive seamless care transitions no matter where they are in their care. Minnesota is one of 8 states selected to participate in this 2-year federal demonstration. There are 6 CCBHCs in Minnesota, in cities like Crookston, St. Paul, Mendota Heights, and Rochester, to name a few. In the 20 months of demonstration, CCBH have served over 17,000 clinics with amazing outcomes. One example includes reducing the time between a client first presenting at a clinic and initial service from 22 days to an average of 11. The demonstration started July 1, 2017 and will end on June 30th of this year. House File 1250 will provide the state of Minnesota the authority to move CCBHC from a demonstration to an ongoing medical assistance service model with federal approval. It also expands the model to certify additional agencies as CCBHs throughout Minnesota. This includes integrating two agencies that recently received federal grant funding to build out the infrastructure of CCBHC. Here with me this evening are a couple of testifiers to share details and the impacts of each of their CCBHCs.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Pahua Yang.
Good evening, everyone, members of the committee. I'm Pahua Yang, Vice President of Community Mental Health and Wellness at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation. We are a CCBHC right down the road. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today about our experience. Becoming a CCBHC has been the most exciting and transformative experience in my 20 years in the mental health field. As a mental health clinician in this state, as well as others, I won't name which, I have watched as we, the collective we, have continually failed some of the most vulnerable people in our society. We can't get to people when, where, and how they need to be served. CCBHCs were created to address these very issues. I want to tell you about Cha, that's not his real name. Cha was brought to our clinic by his elderly parents who don't speak English. When he first came to Wilder, Cha was using drugs and alcohol daily, living on the streets, and his family was afraid and ashamed of him. And he was in a lot of emotional pain. After participating in our family-based mental health and substance use disorders treatment program, he stopped using. He finally began addressing and was able to start addressing the mental illness that drove him to the drugs and alcohol. And he found housing and is looking for a job. Most importantly, he is finally on the recovery path. He went from being a statistic to becoming again the beloved son, brother, uncle, grandchild, and cousin that his family knew. Without the CCBHC, the ability to serve Cha and his entire family in a way that truly matched their needs would not have been possible. Recently, a parent of another child that we serve caught me in the hallway at Wilder, and he said to me, "Whatever you are doing is incredible." And he proceeded to explain to me that prior to coming to Wilder, they had called a bunch of other mental health clinics, and everywhere there was a 4 to 6 month wait list. This is not unusual, and it's especially not unusual for children. When he called Wilder, we were able to offer them an appointment that very same day. And as he thanked me, his eyes filled with tears. And it was that moment that I knew that all the hard work that my team and I, as well as our colleagues all across the state and at DHS, had put into turning ourselves upside down and inside out to become a CCBHC was worth it. I ask you today to support the sustainability and the expansion of the CCBHC work so that we can continue this good work and make this model available to more families in our state. I ask this of you not only as the person who is leading my team through this work in our community, but as a therapist, as a member of the community, and most of all, I ask this of you as a person who loves several people who need the kind of treatment that CCBHCs provide so that they have the opportunity to heal and to help us make a better world for their generation and the next. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Will the next testifier come to the table, please? Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Mike Turpin. I'm with People Incorporated Mental Health Services. Members of the committee, I'm here to speak in support of House File 1250 on behalf of People Incorporated. People Incorporated is the largest community-based mental health provider in the state, and we directly provide mental health services and substance use disorder treatment to over 15,000 clients each year in residential, outpatient, and other community settings. We're also a CCBHC serving Anoka County, Dakota County, Hennepin County, and Ramsey County. Through December of 2018, People Incorporated served over 8,000 discrete consumers through our CCBHC. People Incorporated supports this bill because we believe in the CCBHC model of care, and we believe that Minnesota should expand, support, and sustain this model. We believe in this model because we believe it offers significant qualitative and quantitative benefits both to the individuals served and to the state as a whole. Outside of the CCBHC model, the care provided to the populations we serve populations that are some of the most vulnerable and complex is often disjointed and segmented based upon the discrete funding sources. For example, an individual facing homelessness may be steered towards one program or service funded to help address homelessness, then to another program funded to help address their substance use disorders, and then to another to address their mental health treatment. This segmentation is a barrier to the programs addressing the whole person, and serves as a barrier getting at the complexity of dealing with all the issues that they're struggling with. This disjointed approach can also add to the traumas that an individual has faced, thus further hindering their recovery. So the CCBHC really offers a model that can allow a provider to address all the needs of an individual in a way that both integrates their care and reduces the trauma that they may face. On a quantitative basis, we have data showing that this model is yielding benefits. We're seeing that come in already, even though in the short time that we have had it stood up, we're seeing some of the data come in already. For example, we've collected depression data from four of the six CCBHCs from July 2017 through December of 2018. And in this time, we have seen statistically significant decreases in the depression severity for the consumers that we serve. For these individuals, these decreases in depression severity can certainly yield immediate quality of life benefits for the individuals themselves, but also may have some medium-term benefits, such as decreasing those individuals' needs for ER visits or psychiatric hospitalizations. And in the long term, benefits such as decreasing individuals' risk of future diabetes and heart disease, just two illnesses that have been identified where depression is a known risk factor, can also add to the long-term benefits for those individuals. Additionally, we believe that beyond the benefits to the individuals, these gains in treatment efficacy have the potential to yield savings to the state in the future. Not immediate savings, but rather the potential to provide savings by decreasing costs in the long term to the whole system. So for all these reasons, People Incorporated supports this bill to extend and sustain the CBHC model in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1250? Is there discussion from the committee? Representative Albright.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman, I know that this policy or this program has been in place for a couple of years now, and I know that there was initial conversation when this bill was brought before the committee about a waiver being provided by CMS. Has that waiver been received by the state?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair. Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Jenny Palin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And Madam Chair and Representative Albright, the 1115 waiver that you're referring to has been submitted by the state, and what I understand is they are still in ongoing conversations with CMS for approval of that waiver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another question for the author of the bill.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman, in light of that, what happens if we don't receive the waiver?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think that we would be taking a big risk to lose a very successful pilot program. I would not foresee that, but I guess I can't rule that out. Perhaps one of the testifiers has more information on that as well, if there's an appeal process for a program that is in place and working so well. And it's not working just well in Minnesota, but I understand that the other eight states that have been involved in this program are all seeking to continue it because of the great success they've had in their locations as well. So we can get some more information, or perhaps you have an answer to that as well.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, my understanding is this legislation would expand that authority to allow the state of Minnesota to also apply for a state plan amendment, so that we might be able to make this a continued ongoing service under Medicaid under that route through federal approval.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author of the bill or the testifier, then, what is the timeline for a request of that waiver?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, the expiration is the 30th of
June, so we should have an answer by before then.
Madam Chair.
I'm going to rephrase the question for the author of the bill.
Representative.
This is not to the waiver from CMS for the extension of the program as a pilot, but to have reimbursement provided under Medicaid.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Albright, if I may, I may ask the department to come down and respond. We've been working with them, but I think they have the details of that timeline.
Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. Representative Albright, would you mind repeating the question?
Representative Albright.
So we've been talking about this is a really important program, and so please understand I'm not trying to, you know, we're asking for the federal government to accept a waiver so that we can expand this program in its current condition. But in light of the risk that that isn't received, and then to the other testifier's question that we ask for a waiver under state MA, what's the process for that? So that is there a synchronicity of one dovetail into the other if CMS doesn't come through for us?
Mr. Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. So this is actually a really excellent question for the committee to get into. The 1115 waiver authority, which is what we're actively seeking, and that we have the current state law authority to pursue for the six sites, those waivers are discretionary. So CMS does not have the same type of set timelines and things like that that we did in other fashions. With this bill, we'd be able to seek a state plan amendment. And with that process, there are actually prescribed timelines by which CMS has to respond to the state, and it's a more structured process. We're also able to hold an effective date with CMS that allows us to kind of continue the process while we're awaiting that approval. So it's a more, I would say, a more straightforward and a more successful model in terms of not having to be at the discretion of the federal government in the same way that the 1115 demonstration is.
Mr. Burdick, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
It sounds like you've got a fallback position as you move forward, but when will we know if that fallback position needs to be implemented in light of what CMS, to your point, is in a discretionary position to grant a continued waiver for funding? And is there a difference in terms of the reimbursement or the funding itself, whether it comes from CMS through the waiver program or through the application process that you described through the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think it's very difficult to know when we'd have to exercise any fallback mechanisms. We think that the mechanism that this bill implements is a more secure mechanism. This is also something that the governor has in his budget, so it's an approach that we think is a more secure path forward. But at this time, I don't have any definitive timelines in the federal government, something we want to be in communication with the legislature as the session moves on.
Mr. Burdick, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burdick, if you were a betting man, I don't know you're not, what's the risk that CMS doesn't come through for us?
Mr. Burdick.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I would never speculate on what the federal government would do, so I can't answer that question, unfortunately.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright, and then we have another question.
Yes, I appreciate the candor, Mr. Burdick. I just hope that we're not dangling out a carrot of hope for these folks and these entities. I appreciate the strength of our fallback position. I just hope that CMS, in their inimitable wisdom, finds the virtue of this as we all do around the table. So, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our guests and the author. You know, I remember when we authorized this, and one of the really exciting promises of it was the integration of substance abuse and mental health treatment, because too often in our service system that's been treated separately, and yet they're so often co-occurring. And so I'm excited that the pilots have proven their worth and moved on. But I am a little bit concerned about the language that I need to understand in drafting it, why the only reference to integrated treatment on lines 2.25 to 2.27 has been deleted, and that the CB, I'm sorry, I keep CBHCs, we have so many acronyms, I got to make sure I get the right one. CCBHC are certified to provide integrated treatment for co-occurring mental illness and substance abuse disorders under Minnesota rules. And I'd like to better understand why we would not continue in the bedrock statutes to insist on that ability to have integrated treatment. The language does have both substance abuse and mental health throughout, but this is the only language that says it would be integrated. And I don't think we want, you know, patients once again bouncing from, you know, the hallway to the left for your CD and the hallway to your right for your mental health issues. And so if I could better understand why we dropped that language, that would be helpful.
Mr. Burdick.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, yes, this reference here is to a specific state certification that's actually somewhat duplicative of what's in the federal guidelines for this model. So a lot of the pieces in this bill reference back to the federal model, which emphasizes exactly as you talked about the integrated co-occurring model. This specific state-level certification, which is applied to certain programs that we have in our state, did not add any value above and beyond what the federal guidelines laid out in this regard. And it was sort of another hoop for these providers to jump through. One of the things that you're seeing in this statute is we've taken our current array of services, and then we're actually doing a standard licensing variance for these providers to say that where things are duplicative of each other or with the federal guidelines, that we're creating a more reasoned infrastructure for this. A future project that we'd like to see is actually come back and codify truly what a CCBHC looks like in state law as part of a broader effort to bring some order to our mental health regulatory structure. But right now we're really relying on that federal guidelines and parameters, and we'd be happy to share more information on what that looks like.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Burdick. I maybe am old-fashioned, but I think state direction should be clear in statute about what we expect, even if it's and while you may need to take off the certification because it's duplicative because of what they have to go through for federal requirements, I do think it's important for us to, in statute, define to the public and for our peers who don't sit on this committee what the goal is of this service. And you have many other sub-clauses that do not require a certification or approval through the feds, but do outline what we expect, and none of them reference integrated. So I would hope that before we get to the Finance Committee, you'd be willing to entertain with me some language that really communicates to someone who might be a mental health student or a substance abuse student who's trying to understand the service system that they're going to be going into, that this truly is an integrated model, and that's the goal. Thank you.
Mr. Burdick? No comment. Okay. Are there other questions from the committee? There being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 1250 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1250 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right, so I'm taking over the gavel here, over here. Representative Morrison, we're going to hear House File 742. Representative Morrison is going to move. Oh, I'm sorry, 909. Wrong bill. Right author, wrong bill. Okay, House File 909. And that is going to be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means. Okay. Representative Morrison, please go ahead and present House File 909.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. The Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative is an MDH grant program that was established to address health disparities for populations of color and American Indians as compared to whites. The program periodically awards competitive grants to organizations and tribes across Minnesota. While Minnesota leads the nation in many aspects of health care, too many of Minnesota's African American and American Indian women die during pregnancy. It's a little known fact among many Minnesotans that African American and American Indian women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes compared to their white counterparts, and this is regardless of education or income. Additionally, their infants are more than twice as likely to die in the first year of life than white infants. This is unacceptable. We can and we must do better. House File 909 is a bipartisan bill that adds access, to and utilization of high-quality prenatal care to the list of priority areas of the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative. And I have a testifier.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Good evening, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Dr. Nathan Chomolo. I'm a pediatrician and internist who lives and practices in the Twin Cities. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, as well as Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity, to support House File 909. Timely and adequate prenatal care is critical for both a mother and child's health. We know it helps improve birth outcomes by reducing the incidence of low birth weight and preterm births, and can help reduce rates of infant death and long-term disability. And as Representative Morrison has stated, in Minnesota, the preterm birth rate among American Indian and Alaska Native women is 58% higher than the rate among other women, with 3 times as many of black women and 5 times as many as American Indian and Alaska Native women receiving inadequate prenatal care as compared to their white counterparts. Supporting prenatal care by meeting mothers and families where they are at through innovative programs like home visiting has been shown to have a 2-generation impact. Mothers have improved parental attitudes, increased self-esteem, and reduced anxiety. Children have higher birth weights, stronger early social emotional skills, including reduced aggression and increased empathy. And the impact has been seen as far out as 12 years of age, with children having statistically significant improvements in cognition, as well as math and reading achievement test scores. For all these reasons, I encourage you to vote in support of House File 909, as will help give much-needed funding to explore and find solutions to decrease the inequity we see here in Minnesota, help give our mothers the care they need, our children the best possible start. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Chomolo.
Chomolo, yes.
Chomolo. All right. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? All right. I'm not seeing any. Are there other testifiers?
No, there are not.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or with concerns on the bill? Not seeing any. So with that, then, Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 909 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. We will now hear which one, Representative Morrison, do you want to do? Representative Morrison, do you have a preference on which bill goes next?
742. House File 742, Madam.
742. Okay, we will hear House File 742. So Representative Morrison moves that House File 742 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And there is an author's amendment.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the A1 author's amendment.
And Representative Morrison moves the A1 author's amendment. And do members have that? Okay. And Representative Morrison, do you want to just tell us what that is? Do you want to just adopt it first, and then we'll discuss the bill with that in?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes,
so Representative Morrison moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. Okay, Representative Morrison, please go ahead and present House File 742 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, new research in areas such as brain development is showing that young children, including infants, can experience mental health problems. In the report From Neurons to Neighborhoods, we learned that 85% of brain development occurs in the first 3 years of life, as well as differences in brain structure and function based on the child's experiences and relationships with others and in their social context. The early experiences of children have a profound impact on emotional development. According to a report on the impact of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, stressful or traumatic childhood experiences such as abuse, neglect, witnessing domestic violence, or growing up with alcohol or other substance abuse, mental illness, parental discord, or crime in the home are a common pathway to social, emotional, and cognitive impairments that lead to increased risk of unhealthy behaviors, risk of violence or revictimization, disease, disability, and premature mortality. Mental health services that treat young children with mental illnesses in the context of their families are especially effective ways to respond to the intergenerational nature of early childhood mental illnesses. An estimated 17,565 children between the ages of 0 and 5 have serious mental health needs in Minnesota. Too often, mental illnesses in young children are left untreated or misunderstood as behavioral challenges. Young children in pre-kindergarten are expelled at more than 3 times the rate of students in K through 12. The rate is even worse for young kindergartners in child care centers, where they are expelled at 13 times the rate of K through 12 students. In 2007, the Minnesota Legislature approved funds to enhance early childhood mental health capacity, with the legislature awarding early childhood mental health grants in 2015 to continue this work. House File 742 is a bipartisan attempt to address some of the challenges I just described. Section 1 makes a targeted investment to support mothers on MFIB child only. House File 742 provides up to 20 hours of child care a week for children under the age of 6 upon the recommendation of the treating mental health professional. This will ensure that the child is in a safe environment while the parent seeks intensive mental health treatment or when the child requires consistent care. Without protections like this, caregivers may be forced to choose between receiving necessary mental health treatment or caring for their child. Section 2 allows for grant funding to promote and develop the capacity of mental health providers to offer multi-generational mental health treatment. Multi-generational mental health treatment is an evidence-based practice that provides coordinated mental health services to both children and their caregivers, often with a focus on trauma-informed care. Section 2 also clarifies that a child does not need targeted case management in order to receive respite care, a service that gives a child's caregivers a break to recharge their batteries. Some counties mistakenly believe that targeted case management is a requirement, so this will ensure that more families have access to this service. This bill also increases funding for early childhood mental health consultation, a valuable service that builds the capacity of early learning providers to support infant and young children's emotional development and to prevent, identify, or reduce mental health challenges. In 2016, Minnesota spent over $5 million providing intensive mental health services to 68 young children who were expelled from child care. Mental health consultation could have prevented the expulsion of many of these children at a fifth of the cost. Focusing on early childhood mental health saves money and leads to better outcomes for Minnesota kids.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Ms. Abderholden, did you want to testify on this?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please go ahead.
Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. You're going to have testifiers talking about the early childhood mental health, but I just want to spend a few minutes on the child care portion of this. So if you are deemed disabled, if you're a mom, you're deemed disabled by the Social Security Administration, your child will be on what we call MFIP child only. And because you're deemed disabled, you are not required to work. And because you're not required to work, you don't qualify for child care. And the problem comes in is if the mom is experiencing postpartum depression, just depression, anxiety, bipolar, anything like that in those early years, if she doesn't have family members that she can rely on to take care of the child, while she may need intensive outpatient, day treatment, something like that, she often has to choose between getting the treatment she needs and putting the child perhaps in a precarious situation. The other issue we run into is when a parent is exhibiting those symptoms, they may not be in a good place to actually respond consistently to that child. And we all know what happens if you, as a parent, are not responding consistently to a child. You really dysregulate that child. You really disrupt their good mental health and their ability to grow and develop. So we also want to make sure you have a mental health professional who would say, you know, we need you to be in this intensive outpatient treatment. We're going to make sure that your child gets child care so you can get the treatment. Or the mental health professional says, you're not doing well with your mental health right now. We want to make sure that you're in the caretaking, you know, your child is being taken care of by someone who can respond consistently. You will also then get those 20 hours of child care, which we think will be a really good investment for children and for that parent. Lastly, I just want to touch base on the respite care. You know, respite care is a wonderful program. I was a respite care provider in Hennepin County for over a decade, and a really important piece. But when we require parents to get targeted case management to access respite care, they may not need that, right? And then if they are a middle-income family, they're going to have to go on TEFRA and also pay a fee. And so why go through all that rigmarole when all they need to do is to get that simple respite care? So we just wanted to make that clear in the statute. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Loeffler had a question to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Abderholden, I'm looking at the language on page 2 that deals with the access to that child care, and I'm thinking of the situation. I've talked to some people who are OBGYNs who are involved with high-risk mothers, and maternal depression postpartum can happen very quickly or it can happen later. But for the mothers for whom it happens very quickly, they have told me it's very hard to get that mother certified for mental health treatment. There's in many places a real shortage of appointments to get assessed and evaluated, and they really feel like valuable time is being lost. They don't really want to lose that bonding period with the child by having to bring in child protection services or other things if they're concerned about the mother's ability to deal with the pressures that she's got in her life. And so I'm wondering if you would think it might be wise to at least say for children under 6 months of age that another physician could certify the need or in some other way, just because of that shortage of getting into those mental health appointments at that really critical time.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we would have no objection to that. We also know when it happens quickly. So in this situation, we're talking about moms who've already been certified as disabled. So it's not just right after the baby is born. And we've been very supportive of Hennepin Health's Mother Baby Program, where they're actually, you know, when they're under 6 months, you really actually want the mother and baby together during that treatment, that's actually producing the better outcomes. And we also now have Postpartum Support International in Minnesota, and they've actually been certifying mental health providers around the state who go through special training to know how to deal with postpartum depression and anxiety. But I don't have a problem with changing that.
Representative
Loeffler? Well, great. I appreciate that. We can follow up later, but I just had heard stories of families that had run into issues.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing forth this bill. I just had a question also about the child care. Who would choose the child care? Does the mother choose the child care or the mental health provider? And, you know, if you could just elaborate more what type of child care is provided. Is it in the home or do they have to go to a center or is that just up to each parent? Thank you.
Abderholden.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. It would be up to the parent. You know, it might be that there's a very close in-home child care provider that might work best or, you know, a center. So it would really be, frankly, up to the parent and if there's an opening.
Okay, Representative Robbins? Okay. Chair Leadley?
Well, I don't think I was on the list, Madam Chair, but we might be ready for another testifier.
Okay. All right. So the next testifier. Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this question is actually for Ms. Abderholden, if she wouldn't mind. So, Ms. Abderholden, on page 2, There's an addition, lines 2.12 through 2.15. I understand the language, and I understand the 20 hours per week, but is it for an indefinite period of time, or is there a time certain? Or does it continue until the recovery or the situation is alleviated?
Ms. Abderholden.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. It would be based on the recommendation of the mental health professional. So if the treatment period was going on for, at least that's how we interpreted it. This is our third year with this bill. But that's how we interpreted it. So if the mental health professional is saying, this has got to be for a longer period of time because the mom is not responding consistently, we didn't want to set an exact time. If she's doing well, for example, in intensive outpatient, it might be for a much shorter period of time. But we were a little worried about putting an exact time limit on it since recovery is hard to predict.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 3, on line 3.17, it talks about evidence-based interventions. Is that, are those programs that you're going intending to create new, or are they already in existence?
Mrs. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, that's actually existing language on 3.17.
Not a test.
But yes, the answer is yes, but...
I underlined it, and then I circled it, so I mistook my underline for what was not in the bill. Madam Chair, one final question for Ms. Abderholden or for the author of the bill. On page 5, under the appropriation section, and I'm not asking about the appropriation, that's the Chair of Finance's domain, and so certainly want to respect that. But in lines 5.26 through 5.30, there is a long... elaborative preamble about the types of programs that you intend to promote, develop, and the intentions of those. Can you flesh that out a little bit more for the committee in terms of what that looks like, or are we unsure at this point what they look like?
This is Abderholden.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, there are evidence-based multi-generational programs so that you are working with, in some cases, the entire family. So you could have, you know, a mom or a dad who has a mental illness. Their child also has a mental illness. And the problems when we do it just by each generation is it's not coordinated and there's not good communication. There has been a small program at the Department of Human Services to work with just a few mental health providers to carry this program out. But what they're seeing, especially with the, frankly, increased numbers of families entering child protection, and it really is because the parent has a mental illness and the child does too, we don't have enough capacity to actually meet the need.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, our next testifier is Mary Lynn. Okay. We have Beth Rose. Please, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Hi, I'm Beth Rhodes. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist at a community mental health center in St. Cloud. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So increasing funding for early intervention services, such as mental health consultation, will ensure Minnesota continues to take the lead to be proactive rather than reactive in addressing mental health with children and families. We all know parenting well is difficult, but add poverty, mental illness, and trauma, and it becomes almost insurmountable. Young children are especially vulnerable to the effects. Through support and evidence-based early interventions, Minnesota can take the lead in breaking the cycles of poverty, trauma, and mental illness.
Thank you for your testimony. We have Mary Lynn. Ms. Lynn.
You're so welcome.
Welcome to the committee. Can you please introduce yourself for the records and proceed with your testimony?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Lynn. I'm a licensed psychologist, and I work for a community mental health center in the St. Cloud area. I work with children and families for all of my career. And since about 2007, I've worked mostly with what we call littles, children from birth to six. So that's been my primary focus. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about these children and about the future of our state and where we're going. By investing in children at the earliest possible time, we create healthy fostering environments and avoid higher costs for treatment later in life. The first 5 years of a child's life is the groundwork for their entire life. Their developing brain is being built and it's being wired. In a positive, supportive environment, a child can grow and thrive as they organize who they are and what the world means to them. They need a responsive and caring adult who can do what's called a serve and return effect. Brain architecture and neurological development can be negatively impacted by stressors such as premature births, prolonged separation from primary caregivers due to accidents, deployment or illness, divorce or death. Traumatic events such as physical or sexual abuse, being in a home where there's domestic violence, or when a parent has chemical or mental health concerns. Repair can occur when a child can have a caregiver who is sensitively responsive and attuned to meet their needs and to foster their positive development. Again, it lays the development, the groundwork for their entire life. Many children are cared for by child care providers, whether it be in the home or the community. We entrust these child care providers to be the child's go-to person when they're in distress, to help calm and regulate them, to organize their brain, and to let them know they're okay, to offer safety, consistency, and predictability. Child care providers are not always equipped. They might misinterpret emotions and behaviors, or they might not know how to respond to some of a child's challenging or behaviors that the child might demonstrate when they're exposed to traumas. Mental health consultation in child care settings is providing the education and tools needed for child care providers to help vulnerable children thrive. I'd like to offer a story about a referral that came through our center. For mental health consultation in a child care setting, stating that a child in a child care setting was showing significant disruptive and aggressive behaviors. After meeting with the parent, the therapist validated the significant loss and grief due to the father's military deployment. The father was struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, and it was impacting his family and his children. The child care providers were lacking on knowing how to work with these challenging children and who displayed aggressive behaviors and misunderstood its cause. Rather than refusing the child care services for the child, the providers were willing to meet and to learn about mental health consultation, receive education and support, and interventions on how to respond. The services were put into place and the course of care resulting in a healthier environment for the child and the child care center, while laying the groundwork for ongoing treatment for both the child and the family. This truly was a success story. Sean Koff from the Center of Developing Children from Harvard University in 2008 said, "Positive relationships and quality living experiences are like putting money in the bank." Madam Chair and members, thank you so much for your time.
And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 742? Any discussion, questions from members? Great. There being no further discussion, Representative, the Chair would like to renew her motion that House File 742, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevailed and House File 742, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Our next bill up is House File 637. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move House File 637. House File 637.
I just want to make sure that members have the bill before you, correct? You do have an author's amendment?
Yes. I apologize, Madam Chair. I'd like to move author's amendment. Is it the A2 amendment?
Okay. Representative Morrison moves the A2 author's amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Morrison, I believe your bill would be referred to the Judiciary and Civil Law Division. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please present your bill.
House File 637 modifies Chapter 214 related to criminal background checks and temporary suspensions on behalf of all of the health-related licensing boards, and the exception in Chapter 364 regarding licensing for the boards of chiropractic examiners, medical practice, and nursing. This is a very technical bill, and so I will turn it over to the testifiers to further explain.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Could you please introduce yourself, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Ruth Martinez. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. Madam Chair, members, we are bringing forward this bill to make several changes to a section of statute that affects the 16 health licensing boards, particularly around criminal background checks and temporary suspension of licenses. And we are addressing a couple of things in this common section of statute. This is a section of the statute that applies to all of the boards, as the author mentioned. And, as is often the case, when we implement a new section of law, we learn that it needs to be tweaked a bit. And so all of the 16 health licensing boards implemented criminal background checks as of January 1st, of 2018. And in operationalizing criminal background checks, we've discovered a few areas in that section of statute that just need to be modified somewhat. And so we are looking at modifying some of the language around the fingerprint-based background check. And we are trying to just clean up some of these sections that have already been implemented and are a little bit redundant and unnecessary at this point in time. So some of the revisions will address an issue that happens with several of the boards. For example, a registered nurse might have to do a criminal background check for the RN license and then is immediately eligible for the advanced practice registered nurse license, but has to go through a second criminal background check, sometimes even a day or two after the issuance of that first license. So when there are issuance of additional levels of licensure with the same board, the bill creates an exception so that the individual only has to go through one criminal background check with the same board within 1 year for those different levels of licensure. The provision, as I mentioned, makes the criminal background check valid for 1 year. The change also provides clear authority for the board to authorize a request for a criminal background check for a current licensee, and this is particularly important for the Board of Medical Practice in trying to participate in the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, a law that was passed in 2015. We're still not fully participating because Chapter 214 authorizes criminal background checks for initial licensure, but not for current licensees. So we have explicit authority in this bill to request the criminal background check for the purpose of participation in a compact. And as other professions are pursuing compacts, we imagine that other boards will find that language useful as well. We are also, eliminating duplication by removing a 90-day time frame in which the fingerprint had to be provided. It's just not necessary. The applicant can't get licensed without completing the fingerprinting, so we have just removed that language because it's just not necessary and just requires extra cost for the applicant. We've also eliminated an additional set of prints and cost. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension will process two sets of fingerprints for one fee. If the prints are rejected a second time, which can happen, healthcare workers wash their hands frequently, and sometimes the prints don't come through. So that additional set of prints was at additional cost to the applicant, and this just brings it into alignment with what the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the FBI fee would be for a second set. So we'd like to reduce that language to just require two sets and then go to a name and birth date search if the prints are rejected the second time. And finally, we've added some language under Chapter 214.10, Subdivision 8, which explicitly states that criminal history record information will not be shared with other states or with anyone else. And this, again, is in response to concerns raised by the FBI that had worries that under our current data practices language that we had that opportunity to share criminal history record information, even though that has never been the intent of a licensure compact. But this explicitly makes that statement. And I'll turn it over to Ms. Brecken to review some of the additional changes.
Thank you so much. Introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair. My name is Shirley Brecken, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Nursing. Section 6 specifically addresses temporary suspension. All of the health-related licensing boards have the authority to do temporary suspension in cases where there's an imminent risk of harm to the public. And there are some requirements within that provision that have one in particular has become a little bit of a sticking point. The temporary suspension, if the board takes imposes a temporary suspension, the board must be prepared and must go to hearing within 30 days. The administrative law judge then has 180 days with which to conduct the hearing and respond to the board and make findings of fact and conclusions of law, which the board then uses to make a decision about discipline or if there is a recommendation for discipline. There's a requirement then that the board must, again, conduct the hearing within 30 days, and this has become somewhat of a problem for some of the boards because most of the boards meet either every other month or every 3 months, and so the effect has been that there has been a need to call a special meeting of the board, and sometimes the real problem with that is getting a quorum when you have to call a special meeting as opposed to a regularly scheduled meeting. So we worked with the Chief Administrative Law Judge and the original authors of the bill to look at what would be a reasonable time frame, and we would like to increase the maximum timeline from 30 days to 60 days between the receipt of the Administrative Law Judge's report and final action by the board following a temporary suspension. The exception to that would be if the administrative law judge would recommend no discipline, then the board would have to convene the hearing within 30 days so that the individual's license could be reinstated and the individual could go back to work. I'd also like to address the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment actually addresses two issues. First of all, it deletes the phrase other biometric data, which was a concern raised in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee when we had that hearing. It was really inserted into the bill to address future technology. However, it was not defined, and committee members stated it could be addressed when such technology becomes available or commonly used. The amendment also applies to the exception for the boards of chiropractic examiners, the Board of Medical Practice, and the Board of Nursing in Chapter 364.09, commonly referred to as the Criminal Rehabilitation Act. It adds to paragraphs D, E, and F a provision that the exception not only applies to licenses that have been revoked or suspended, but also to the license application process. This is in the same manner as it is for teachers. The effect is that it would create an exception to allow the boards to receive arrests and charges in the criminal background check data. Currently, the BCA has to redact that data from the criminal history report, and the boards really recognize that having that additional information, especially if there's pending court trials, would help the boards to make well-informed decisions in the licensure process and assure the public that and employers that individuals who work with vulnerable persons have the ability, capacity, and fitness to do so. And it would also expedite the receipt of the criminal background check information by eliminating the need for redacted reports. And adopting this amendment will align the bill with Senate File 583 as it passed out of committee in the Senate, where it has been sent to the floor. And with that, we stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify in support or opposition of House File 637? Is there any discussion from committee members? All right. There being no further discussion, the chair. Okay, I'm sorry. Need you to renew your motion. Okay. There being no further discussion, Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 637 be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 637 is recommended for a re-referral to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So our next bill up is House File 473, Representative Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 473 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, we have the bill before the committee. Representative Liebling.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I also have an A1 amendment that I would like to move to put the bill in the shape in which I would like to discuss it.
Okay, Representative Liebling moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the amendment gets the bill back to the way it was when Representative Zerwas carried it last session. This is a, if members remember, this goes back to a little provision that was added in a conference committee that basically had the DHS change the way it purchases incontinence products for people who are on MA. And this was done to save a little bit of money at the end of conference committee when a few bucks were needed, probably a little more than a few bucks. But this has created some problems, and a lot of members have heard about this, I know. So I'm going to just turn it over to my testifier here and let her describe this in a little bit, maybe a little more coherently, given the late hour, and in a little more detail.
I know. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here this evening. My name is Sarah Anderson, and I am the Senior Vice President for Home Care Delivered and also a member of the Board of Directors for the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Supplies and Services, commonly known as MAMES. I am here today to represent providers across Minnesota who were truly blindsided by this provision when it was included in the special session budget negotiations that Representative Liebling referenced, and to support the repeal of this language. This language was proposed by the Department of Human Services during the budget negotiations, and it resulted or would result in an almost 35% cut to the incontinence benefit in Minnesota. Prior to this proposal and throughout the last decade, Minnesota has been recognized as a national leader among state Medicaids for its work and emphasis on quality over quantity in our incontinence program. We have worked with the disability community providers and the Department of Human Services collaboratively to reduce the overall number of products that we provide to Minnesota enrollees by over 67%. We reduced the number of pieces provided per month from 950 down to, depending on the type of products that you're using, an average of 360 pieces. So that's a pretty dramatic reduction in previous reforms. And so we felt that this provision was really not necessary given all of the quality work that we had done in the past. Under the program, that was under the RFP, the requirement in 2017, there was a request for proposals to do competitive bidding that was required to be implemented by July of last year. The legislature repealed this provision last year. It was included in the omnibus budget, late hour. and as we all know, that budget was vetoed. So this provision went into effect. The department issued their RFP, and our trade association was forced to respond. We did petition the department for rulemaking because the language that passed in 2017 was very ambiguous and we believed unimplementable. When we didn't receive a response from the rulemaking petition, we were forced to file a temporary restraining order in the Ramsey County courts to prevent the language from going into effect, from the RFP from going into effect. And in late August of 2018, Judge Castro issued the temporary restraining order barring the implementation of the Preferred Incontinence Program as it exists. That temporary restraining order was upheld after a motion to dismiss was filed. In November, it was upheld. And in December, the department and MAMES entered into a stay, giving the legislature in this session an opportunity to repeal or correct the ambiguous statute. Because of the work we've done in the past and because of the belief in quality product over quantity product leading to better outcomes for Minnesotans and the belief that our members as well as the supportive community members and the disability community which supports this repeal, including the Citizens for or Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, we urge the legislature to repeal this once again, hopefully for good this time, and do so in 2019's legislation. I'm happy to stand for any questions or to ask or to answer any questions about the history of our coverage of this issue. But I thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. So anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 473? Is there any discussion, questions from members? Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lee. I just want to say thank you to you and all the other groups have pursued this because I think it was a quick, hasty decision to think that we might be able to save some money but not thinking about the long-term consequences. And if you think about, I was told once that other than dementia wearing out caregivers, the next biggest reason for persons moving into nursing homes was incontinence. Mm-hmm. And think of yourself, if you had leakage issues, small or large, would you dare go visit other people in their house? Would you dare go to a restaurant? Would you dare have the kind of life that you want? Or would you just stay at home socially isolated and feeling like less of a person engaged in the world? And people come in all different shapes and sizes, as we know. And as my understanding is, it's very difficult for some people to find an appropriate fit so that they can actually actively engage in life and move about and have a normal life, whether they're a young person with a disability or an older person who's run into other issues. And so I think we have to continue to bring person-centered care as best we can, even though we want to, whenever we can, reduce the cost of healthcare services when we can. But number one, our goal should be to help people remain as independent and healthful and healthy as long as we can. And I think that providing products that fit and allowing people to try different vendors if the first product doesn't work, a chance to find something that does is worthwhile.
Thank you so much, Representative Loeffler. Do we have any other questions for members? All right. There have been no further discussion. Representative Liebling. renews a motion to House File 473 as amended would be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. House File 473 as amended is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much for bringing the bill forward.
Chair.
So, members, we are at the end.
Wait, what?
We are at the end.
Oh, so
right?
Soon.
So,
No, it's going to get worse.
No, we are adjourned.